Question number 11883, Mr. C. E. Anson, reel 4.
Mr. Anson, reel 4.
By Italian troops with mortars and some artillery fire, which caused some casualties, but on the whole we got away with it very lightly. We were then we then moved after the main forces had come ashore, moved round further towards the east and north to advance towards the town of Syracuse, which was occupied, and where we suffered some air raids, and then to Augusta, where to embark on an assault ship, which was in fact the Dutch Channel packet, the Queen Emma, which had been converted into a very good, fast assault ship capable of carrying two commandos. The idea being to make a seaborne landing in the rear of the German positions, which tenaciously defended the flat plain overlooked by Etna, where the advancing forces had been stopped. By that time, we came under fairly sustained air attack, and Augusta Harbour was a favorite target, and so smoke screens were laid at night, and because we were the outermost ship ready to leave in the early hours on our mission to perform this landing, and the wind being inshore, it fell to us to help lay the smoke screen. We were rather visible as a result, and so I'm afraid some of the Stukas tended to concentrate on us, and we suffered in particular one very near miss, which caused an awful lot of casualties, because most people, being prepared for this landing, had already primed grenades about their person and so on. So there was some carnage down below in the troop decks. The commander doctor was killed, the ship's doctor was killed, the commando medical sergeant with his orderlies had to cope with all this mess, and there were quite a few dead and injured people about. I, because it was a very hot night, had gone on deck and slung my hammock on the quarter deck, and when all the noise started, I simply rolled out of it and lay on my stomach on deck, and when this particular hit happened, a piece of shrapnel apparently penetrated my helmet, which I was wearing at the time, and my skull, and I suffered a head wound, of which I wasn't really aware at the time. It knocked me out. I had sort of typical the typical sensations of being knocked out and coming round again. Coming round again, in fact, very soon, evidently, because I think I was woken up by the fountain of water coming down again, and the ship righting itself after it had been keeled over. And I remember helping another Marine who had shrapnel wounds in his lower abdomen. And there was another Stuka attack, and I took my helmet off to hold it over his face because he had none. And something dripped onto my arm, and I realized it was blood, but I didn't really realize that I may have been particularly hurt. I probably concluded I'd scratched my head somewhere. But this particular aircraft went away, maybe it ran out of ammunition, and I went back, I reported towards morning to the medical sergeant, and said that should he by any chance have any bandages left after being so very busy, I had some scratch on my head probably, and took my helmet off, and couldn't understand why he suddenly looked very serious and told me to sit in the corner on the floor and not to move. And then I did start to feel rather funny, and a marine wanted to give me some rum, which the thought of which made me feel quite ill, and I pushed him away. And in the morning I was evacuated with other wounded as one of the last, and I thought that was because I was really, my wound was really rather trivial, but in fact apparently it was that they hadn't expected me to survive the night anyway, because my brain was exposed through this particular piece of shrapnel, which apparently smashed my skull and slithered round on the inside, where it lodged somewhere inside the skull. Well, I was taken to a light field ambulance, number 151 light field ambulance, in an olive grove in Sicily, where they did an absolutely superb job under these conditions. Horseshoe form tent round the three tunnel with an operating theatre in the back of it, and perhaps a dozen, 10 or 12 beds round it, with Canadian nurses in ice blue uniforms and real sheets. I passed out. By the time I came round again, they had performed what must have been quite a demanding operation in removing bone splinters, etc., and sewing up the skin again, in conditions which must have been very sterile, because the brain is a very vulnerable area for infection. They made a very good job of it. And I had a sort of plaster cast helmet on, which everybody proceeded to autograph for me. Was evacuated to North Africa, to Tripoli, where I spent, I don't know, maybe a couple of weeks in a very nice modern hospital, and from where I was flown in a hospital Dakota to Cairo, where I spent, I suppose, another month at least in the 15th Scottish Hospital at Cairo, which was in fact a fairly modern Italian hospital which had been taken over. It must have been... actual incident was on the night of the 17th of July. I had in fact been in Sicily for only 10 days. The landings were on the 10th of July. I was wounded on the 17th, and from there on, rather out of it. After a sojourn at the 15th Scottish Hospital, I was sent to an infantry reinforcement depot at Geneva, halfway along the Great Bitter Lake on the Suez Canal, where to spend some 3 months, which were extremely tedious and soul-destroying. The medical reason for this was that they do not like to close up a head wound of this kind, if at all possible, before making very sure that there are no tumors, growths, infections, or anything else unpleasant developing, and that the whole thing is really sterile. But that period downgraded to a medical grade of B3 in a tented camp among the sand with nothing but bugles and bullshit from morning till night was really quite soul-destroying. And I had no means of knowing that I would ever get my A1 status back and be able to get back to my unit, myself ending the war as a postal orderly at Geneva. That was not very pleasant. I did have... shall I tell a little anecdote?
Yes.
I did have one rather pleasant experience there, and that was that one day I found in the sand an impression of the SV boot, the SV sole, which stands for Sol Vibram, who is the Belgian designer of that particular pattern. Now, every walking shoe has that kind of pattern on it, and is known as a commando boot or whatever. But at the time, it was a brand new idea, and was applied to army boots by being screwed to the soles of the army boot instead of hobnails, especially for us, in order to allow us to move quietly at night. And also because they are very, very good for climbing, so long as the rock is not too wet. But for going up cliffs and so on, this particular pattern is ideal. And it was peculiar and unique to us. Therefore, if I saw this impression in the sand, I knew this is one of us, and I followed it. I realized at that time, exactly at that point, what Robinson Crusoe must have found when he saw the footprint of Man Friday. I followed it, and I traced it to another part of the camp where I found my good friend Mac Franklin, from my own troop, who had also been wounded in Sicily and had come through a similar, or perhaps a little later in Italy, had come through similar channels to reconvalesce in this particular camp. And we had there was a great hello, and we spent many days and evenings together afterwards, drinking enormous quantities of lemonade. Mac moved heaven and earth to be able to get back to our troop, because he wanted very much to take part in D-Day, and eventually succeeded. Unfortunately, he was actually killed on landing in Normandy, and a great loss, because he was a very, very fine chap. Well, I, on the other hand, had by then become very fond of the Marines, and I wanted to get back to what I now considered my formation, which was to become number 2 Commando Brigade in the Central Mediterranean. And eventually I succeeded in that as well. I had also met one other of my own colleagues in hospital, in the 15th Scottish Hospital. He was rather badly wounded by a shell and received 2 fragments, one lodged behind a spinal column in the neck, which was extremely difficult to remove without causing permanent paralysis. Some nerves were severed, so that afterwards he did walk with a stick. His name was Paul Streeton. He was an economics graduate. And eventually, after getting back to England, managed to get much of the use of his legs back, although he did walk with a stick, went back, completed his studies, became a fellow, and a fellow of Balliol, and I think attained even higher. He was, I think, the head of a college in Sussex, and then went to America. His wife was American. And that's another address I might pass on to you as a person who can give a great deal more information than I can. He has become an economic advisor in America, at the World Bank or similar, and lives partly in Washington, partly in New England, I believe. I will give the addresses later. At the time he was mostly unconscious. I used to read to him, but he was in a very long drawn-out coma. To return to my own fate, I eventually, after another month's delay in the Abbasiyah barracks outside Cairo, while travel arrangements were completed, and having also spent some time in the Alexandria, in a convalescent camp at Alexandria, got back to my unit. I'm afraid I've anticipated here. What happened first was that just before Christmas 1943, I was back in the hospital, in the 15th Scottish Hospital in Cairo, to receive a bone graft with which that hole was closed, and which has held very well ever since. And it was after this that, and after a further period of convalescence in Alexandria, that I was on my way back to Italy and rejoined the brigade, of which number 40 Commando formed a part, who were then in southern Italy and about to go to Yugoslavia. In fact, I think much of the brigade already was on the island of Vis, along of the Croatian coast. And it is there that I joined them again, now part of the intelligence section of No. 2 Brigade under Captain Japp. And there followed a rather idyllic summer, in a way, of 1944, because a lot of units kind of fought their own war in a kind of pirate's existence, with raids along the coast and on coastal garrisons, and some quite unlikely units doing things off their own bat, like artillery units, getting themselves landed, meticulously laying their guns overnight, putting down salvos of rapid fire as a fire raid on a German, unsuspecting German encampment where they were just falling for their breakfast, and then packing up and departing before the dust had cleared.
So you were interrogating prisoners, were you?
That was the main idea, yes. Another also was to act as a German speaker on the loud hailer of motor gunboats or motor torpedo boats in their patrols along the coast, intercepting German craft. I personally never was in on a success like that. I'm rather glad, because I'm a bit of a coward, and that was I would have been rather frightened, no doubt. But the idea was that if we were to intercept a German craft, I would shout the captain's orders to the German crew. There were prisoners of all kinds. The naval ones tended to be terribly inflexible and very fanatical. The army ones tended to be more amenable. And then there were some specials like Sicherheitsdienst and people of that sort. We were opposed principally by the SS Panzer Division Prince Eugen, which was largely made up of Balkan personnel with mostly Austrian Nazi officers, and a highly unpleasant group of people they were, in conjunction with the native Chetniks and Ustashi and other royalist or fascist formations of Yugoslav, of native Yugoslav personnel. So the action consisted of raids on the various islands. The most spectacular of these, as I remember, was a rather hurriedly arranged raid on the island of Brač at the time when Tito was very nearly caught by the Germans at Drvar and only escaped by making a hasty exit through the back of a cave. Asked him to join us, but it was our job at that time to raise quite a lot of noise and dust in order to draw some of these Germans towards ourselves and away from the Drvar area, and hence the raid of Brač on Brač by the Partisan Brigade, the Dalmatian Brigade of Partisans and ourselves, was designed perhaps as a diversionary maneuver, and we spun it out until we could be sure that it had at least some effect, some of the effect desired. A bit uncomfortable to sit on mountaintops watching the headlights of the transport of the SS coming towards, closer towards us, but perhaps I'm embellishing a little bit here. I can't honestly remember seeing any headlights, but perhaps I heard other people mention it. It was successful, perhaps, in the sense in which it allowed Tito to escape, and he then joined us on Vis, where we had various units, apart from the partisans and the commando brigade, consisting of number 40 and 41 Marines, and number 2 and 9 by then. Whether we were all together on Visa, I can't now recall, but they were certainly part of the of number 2 brigade in the Central Mediterranean. He then spent the rest of the of that part of the war on Vis, guarded also partly by RAF regiment. And there were small Air Force units. There were two motor gunboats and two motor torpedo boats of the Navy. There were 4.7 anti-aircraft artillery batteries. So it was quite a military presence. I'm sure there are other records which will give much more detailed information on the war in Yugoslavia in general and on Vis in particular. We went back to Italy probably towards the end of August of 1944 to our bases in the Bari area, south of Bari, and in particular at Monopoli. And I believe it was from there that we traveled south to Rimini, where to embark for Albania on what was supposed to have been a fairly short, sharp action. But I'm afraid after we landed in Albania, the weather broke, with us still being in tropical kit, and sort of cold monsoon-type rain engulfed everything for the next 21 days, making life very difficult indeed, and rather holding up our operation, and producing quite a lot of casualties. We had some 50% casualties from exposure alone, so I was told, quite apart from battle casualties. The Germans, on the other hand, were ensconced in well-fortified and concreted positions, intended to belabor us from time to time with a heavy Austrian, big caliber Austrian mortar, which didn't do a lot of damage, and with 88 millimeter guns from the northern tip of Corfu, which were more effective, especially in that they tended to put shrapnel over the ravines in which we lived, in foxholes and in very wet conditions. But eventually, the rain let up and the operation went forward, resulting in the capture of the small port of Sarande, Santi Quaranta as the Italians call it, which was also quite heavily booby-trapped because it was one of those particular battles where after the last shot is fired, the enemy withdraws and silence reigns except for the bangs of booby traps going off because they had large explosive stores, much of which had been used to booby trap everything in sight. As soon as you looked at anything, it blew up. And there is one particular memorable SORE, Staff Officer Royal Engineers, who in these explosive stores found that the Germans had mined them, and it would have been quite impossible to find the time pencils they used among all this lot of explosives if they had not, with typical German thoroughness, left the cardboard box in which they had been with the safety pins they had withdrawn still inside them, or again inside them, like people putting spent matches back in the box, on the windowsill just by the door, which I suppose is a normal thing to do just before you leave. I mean, you don't set time pencils until you're actually going. And so by the box and its designation, he was able to work out the time delay and calculate from the time of German withdrawal when it was likely to go up, and got everyone to evacuate Sarande and go some way round the bay in which it is situated, where after a slightly longer delay than expected, we did witness a vast explosion which damaged quite a lot of the quayside and would probably damage quite a few of us. At the same time, or perhaps the next day or so, A sudden rumor went round that there were some Germans left on Corfu, and I hope I'm not embellishing, but as my memory serves, a marine and I hopped onto a motor gunboat, which was going to have a look, and went over with it. And it entered the old harbor and touched the quayside, and the marine and I jumped ashore, expecting this boat to tie up, but it didn't. It gunned up its engine and gently slid out again and left us there, surrounded by a crowd of Greeks who hadn't seen an Allied soldier for 4 years, to a tumultuous welcome in which I was kissed by more bearded sea captains than I ever have before or since in my life, and we were dragged into the nearest taverna, filled up with ouzo, and the next 24 hours are very hazy in my memory indeed. But then the rest of the brigade followed, and we spent October of 1944 on Corfu, first in little hotels along the seafront, then in the summer palace, which I believe is the birthplace of Prince Philip, and I personally, being a German speaker, helped with the evacuation of what Germans there were left, who were very courteous and very correct. It wasn't really a formal surrender as much as arranging transport, with their captain, their commander, introducing himself to me very correctly and in friendly fashion as Captain Rabe, uncrowned king of Corfu. And he and his lieutenants and troops embarked on a landing craft and were taken back to Italy proper, to some camp. And in conjunction with the chief of police, Lieutenant Stephen Ioannidis, I was also able to help with the evacuation of the Italian civil population of fascist administrators who were not popular with the Greeks, whom they had kept on very short commons for the past 2 years, and who were in fact housed in the prison for their own protection until we could get them evacuated. I should also add that while we were in Albania, we had quite a lot of German deserters of one form or another who tended to come over to us, and some prisoners, but the deserters were really very interesting people, and some of them came from a unit known as Punishment Battalion 999, Strafbataillon 999, which was for people who were not in good odor with the Nazi authorities. They tended to have fanatic CEOs who watched the only gap in the wire entanglement surrounding their positions with a machine gun, because they were not very reliable, and that's why they found themselves in remote countries which were not at the time in the forefront of operations. Some of these people took the opportunity of coming over, and I remember one who somehow found his way at night through everybody's lines without us spotting him or him spotting us, until he blundered into our headquarters and introduced